Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I am here with Bob Stone, who is the author of Can't Nobody Do Me Like Jesus, Photographs from the Sacred Steel Community. Bob, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm delighted.
I'm hoping you can start by talking a little bit about how you got interested in the Sacred Steel community and putting together this book and this compilation of photographs.
Well, in 1992, I was working as a folklorist for the Florida Folklife Program, which is the offices were located way up in north central Florida near the Georgia border. And a friend of mine, a musician friend of mine, operated one of those go-to stores for musicians way down in South Florida in Hollywood near Fort Lauderdale. And to make a long story short, these African-American men were coming in and they played to buy things and they played steel guitars. And my friend Mike automatically knew that I was always looking for contacts, and he had the sort of store that where a lot of musicians passed through. And he gave me my first contacts, and the first musicians' contact information he got, they said, "Oh, I'm not really that good. You need to hear either Aubrey Gent or Glenn Lee, who were the top players in Florida at the time." And so it went very quickly, really. And of course, what attracted me was that it was when one thinks of the steel guitar, nowadays you'd think of country music, the twangy country music. And previous generations, you might think of Hawaiian music, where the instrument originated. But this stuff had a very much, what they were playing had a very much an African-American voice. If you can imagine hymns, when they played the slow gospel numbers and hymns, imagine if Aretha Franklin played the steel guitar. That's what it sounded like. So we jumped right on it. I got permission from my boss to journey down south and do a reconnaissance trip. Sort of got a few short pieces on digital audio tape at the time, and got a grant from the NEA to do a survey project in Florida, and we were off. But, you know, what really attracted me in the beginning, and all my colleagues as well, was everybody was, wow, this is really something. Just the music itself was incredible.
So before we sort of talk about the photographs you took, as you were talking, it made me want to make sure for people who aren't familiar, for you to maybe describe what the steel guitar is, right? So, and those forms that the sort of two forms that it traditionally takes.
I'm so glad you asked that question. The instrument couldn't be more confusing. Even steel guitarists themselves can't agree on all the terminology, but the instrument gets its name not from the material it's made out of, but from the bar that the player, a right-handed player, would use in his left hands to make notes. Instead of on a standard guitar, you fret it with the fingers of your left hand. On a steel guitar, you use this steel bar to make notes on the strings. And it comes in two forms, what's commonly nowadays called the lap steel, in the old days. And matter of fact, many members of the older members of these churches still refer to the Hawaiian guitar because that's where it originated in the very late 19th century. The more modern form that more people are familiar with is the pedal steel, and that's the instrument that makes that twangy sound you hear in country music. Today, a lot of the players in the sacred steel players in the House of God and the Church of the Living God play the pedal steel, but by and large, they don't make it twang. You can do it. You can play that instrument. It offers a lot of harmonic possibilities without getting the twangy sound. So that's what the instrument is. In fact, just to backtrack a little bit, the earliest players that I documented in the House of God, Keith Dominion, had a direct connection to the Hawaiian music fad of the 1930s. Troman Eason heard a Hawaiian player on the radio in Philadelphia something like probably 1936 or 1937 and took lessons from a Hawaiian. So in fact, many people in the church still call it the Hawaiian guitar or just the Hawaiian.
So you went in and you photographed these churches. And so before, can you talk a little bit about the history of the Pentecost, the history of the House of God and the Church of the Living God and sort of situate us in where you came and entered?
Certainly. The House of God... it's the House of God, Keith Dominion, and the Church of the Living God, Jewel Dominion. And those are shortened versions of the church names. They both have much longer names. But they started out as a common church. It was founded by Mother Mary Tate in 1903. And they claim it to be the earliest Pentecostal church founded by a woman. And I haven't researched that thoroughly, but I have, from what I know, that's probably correct. So they celebrated their centennial in 2003. In 1930, she died suddenly of complications due to frostbite, and the church split into three dominions. There was a very long legal battle. The church already had considerable assets, particularly real estate. And so they split into three dominions. Each one was named after the leader. So it's the Keith, the Jewel, and the Lewis Dominion. The Keith and Jewel Dominions both have this steel guitar tradition, which started in the earliest days of the electric steel guitar, which was in the early and mid-1930s. And rather quickly, the instrument became rose to the hierarchy, the top of the hierarchy in both churches, hierarchy of musical instruments. In other words, it is the instrument that plays the lead part. It plays almost all the time, except during the announcements and the early part of the sermon and during a group prayer. If a service is 2 hours, 2.5 hours long, the steel guitarist is probably playing for 2 hours. And they developed their own way of playing, their own style of playing, their own tunings and instrument set and equipment setups. And this probably a factor that came into play here is that there in the Pentecostal church, Holiness Pentecostal churches, you're either of the church or of the world. And they really didn't officially allow and still don't officially allow their musicians or anyone to listen to secular music or to have it in the home. So they developed their own sort of musical styles. Naturally, of course, some of them did listen to secular music and were influenced by, in the old days, blues and rhythm and blues. And of course, other gospel music quartets, which were popular for so long. And today, similarly, even more so, it's really hard to stop the outside influences. But they developed their own way, and they're very proud of it. They don't want to play like country musicians. They don't want to play like Hawaiian musicians. They have their own way of playing.
And you went in, and so you came in as an outsider, and all your photographs are black and white. And do you want to talk a little bit about that relationship to being able to come in as an outsider and photograph the church, and how you put this sort of collection together, thinking about that and thinking about your role in presenting the church and presenting this community.
Sure. In many ways, this book, especially to me personally, but I think if you look at the overall body of work that I've done, I did a 300-page book for University of Illinois Press, published in 2010. I produced 8 CDs for the Arhuli label. And directed the Arhuli Foundation's documentary video. And then, but still there was something missing and something that is very dear to me. I'm a very much a visual person. And so I really wanted to do this still photograph book. And I must say it's been very, very well received by the community, the musicians and other members of the community whom I keep in touch with. And, so that's really nice that they're so enthusiastic. I started out, of course, yes, I am an outsider. I'm white and I'm not Pentecostal. but right away, we got this very small grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, Folk and Traditional Arts Division. And I got the chief overseer, the national head of the church, just happened to live. He resided in Sarasota, Florida. So I got a letter of support from him. So that really helped. And the very first project was in Florida that I did when I was working for the Florida Folklife Program. Basically, you know, then after that, after 1995, when the Bureau of Florida Folklife relocated to Tallahassee and was no longer a bureau, I stayed here in Gainesville and kept working as a contractor. So that, in a way, freed me up to do this work in other states and even in Florida on my own. And I did it on my own dime and just because I thought this was very, very much worth doing. So, you know, this work went on began in 1992 and I was still pretty active even beyond this photo book stops in 2008, but I think 2006, excuse me, but I continue to do a little work, not too much, but so people would see me over and over and over again. You know, I did some radio programs. They became to trust me and value me you know, the Eason family, Willie Eason, one of the pioneers, they considered me their son. They called me their son. The Lee boys called me Uncle Bob. Some of the other musicians called me Uncle Bob. So I got to be sort of, you know, a member of the community in a sense. And that's, you know, I can't emphasize enough for people that are doing folklore and field documentation of traditional culture that you'd learn quickly that coming back and, you know, working in the long term is so, so much better than the usual short term stuff. You know, we used to jokingly call a lot of our field work slash and burn because we'd come in real quick. 3 hours, give me your story and I'm gone. I'm off to do another person, you know, so it's nice to spend years. People would say, I just saw you in Nashville. Yeah, you know, I'm a Floridian. And I'd say, I saw you in Mississippi. You know, that was all very good. And I've really enjoyed it and continue to enjoy it. I have many friendships that continue, many people that I'm in regular correspondence with.
So the first I'm hearing my echo. The first section of your book or the first series of photographs focuses on the church meeting. And you sort of have not only the building itself, right, from the outside and inside, but a lot and pictures of the steel guitars, but also sort of the community, the praise, all of that. So do you want to share a little bit about that, the church meeting, and what you were trying to sort of present and capture in this group, in this series of photographs?
Certainly. Well, one of the first things I realized is that you can only take so many photographs of steel guitarists before it starts getting boring, even to the person who's most interested in that sort of thing. And so I, as a folklorist, I wanted to present every aspect of the culture that I could. And as you noted, before I show what's going on inside the church, I try and show an exterior shot, give a feel for the architecture, which ranges all the way from these small country churches on dirt sand roads out in the woods to the big grand headquarters church of the House of God in Nashville, Tennessee, which has a 2,000 seat auditorium and bronze statue of the founder out front. And I want to show all the age groups. Youth choruses, and many of the things that go on. I was also, I wanted to show some of the shouting, as it's called, and holy dancing. But that's very easy to sensationalize and sort of exploit. And I didn't want to do that. I want to show that it goes on, but I was very conscious of not overdoing that. And of course, I wanted to show the geographic range, which is all the way from extreme South Florida all the way to upstate New York, out to Mississippi, the Carolinas, Georgia. so that's what I've tried to do. Of course, the interaction between the congregation and the musicians. And I'm just flipping through some pages. They have a somewhat unusual way of handling the offertory. Rather than the collection plates being passed through the congregation, the ushers lead the congregation up front to the collection plates, and they do sort of a swinging, swaggering march. Sometimes, if special events, the ushers will even do full 360-degree turns and dips. And while the band plays swinging music, usually a medley when the saints go marching in, there's a tune that they call the House of God March. I've even showed some of the larger events. There'll be a vendor out in the parking lot, just a local person. As we know, in many African-American communities, people do whatever they can to bring in income, and they may have two or three jobs and might do something like sell candy and snacks during a break at a two or three day assembly, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I appreciated some of the ways in which you presented different angles, right? So it's not only sort of looking directly at the musicians or the front of the church, but those views where you are seem to be in the front of the church, sort of looking out past the musicians at the congregation, right? And showing us sort of different perspectives.
Yes, about the only thing one of the things that you can't do is you can't get up on the pulpit next to the preacher. That's off limits. You can only get so close, no matter how friendly you are. That's just not something you do. But yes, I've as you can see, I've stood right there with the musicians, right looking over the shoulder of the steel guitarist, and so you can see the audience and the steel guitarist interacting. Of course, that's very important to the musicians. They read, I said audience, I meant congregation. They read that congregation. They're there. The musicians are there for one purpose, and that's to enhance the service, to give it energy, enhance whatever's going on. And so they take all their cues from the minister, the preacher, and from the congregation.
Yeah, one of the images that I really liked in this section was one, the worship service, House of God in Rush, New York, where the congregation, for the most part, is kneeling. There are some standing with the musicians playing, and it's very intimate. It's this very intimate picture of that relationship between the musicians and the congregation, and how they use music as a part of their service, right, in worship.
Yes, absolutely. That's a common thing, you know, and call, it's a call to the altar or an altar prayer. And you know, the musicians may or may not play. If they are not playing, they bow their heads and the congregation is up close. And there's usually a minister leading them in prayer, and there may be a couple of minutes of silent prayer. So, yeah, I've tried to document every and present every aspect I could.
Yes, including, I like the ones from Tupelo, Mississippi as well. You have the cooking in the kitchen of the church, I'm guessing of the church, right? But then juxtaposed with a woman with the Elvis Presley fan, and I love that that was from Tupelo.
Yes, so, well, everyone in, of course, you know, a lot of people in Tupelo have an Elvis claim of some sort, but in this case, it's really true. Elvis, when he was living in Tupelo, which was when he was in junior high school, I think, you know, he was already bringing his guitar to school every day and loved gospel music. And he lived on the edge of the neighborhood where the church is and where they had, at the time he was living there, they had these big assemblies, big sort of revivals in tents. So he lived a quarter of a mile from where that tent was. So one of the ministers who worked with me very well, Bishop Wortham, we walked over there. I had information from Peter Goralnik, who wrote that very thorough two volumes on Elvis. And I was able, the house isn't there. Elvis's old house isn't there, but the location still is. So I actually went there and walked around with the bishop. Yeah, so those usually the church fans will have a, you know, image of Martin Luther King or someone praying or something. But in Tupelo, those fans were furnished by the Convention Bureau, and it had a picture of the young Elvis with words about on the obverse side that was the birthplace of Elvis.
So the next sort of section of photos is on wakes, funerals, and tributes. And so can you talk a little bit about the role of all of those, right? We often talk about the funeral, but the wakes and the tributes, all of it together in the church and what you were trying to capture.
Yeah, well, here. Of course, those are some of the, especially the funerals, which they call homegoings, are some of the most emotional moments that in the church setting, and you know, their emotions are very freely expressed. It's not unusual to see somebody faint or fall out or get filled with the spirit that they collapse, especially when they're viewing the coffin, the deceased in the casket. The wakes are the night before, and the wakes, I've seen wakes that were very reserved, in the case of Henry Nelson's wake in New York, but then Glenn Lee's wake down in Perrine, wake, you know, 15, 20 miles south of Miami, that was very, lots of energy, a lot of musicians, lots of holy dancing and shouting, and of course, you know, people give recollections, but the minister at both the wake, well, especially at the homegoing, will say, you know, people are mourning and expressing their feelings, but they'll periodically say, "We're here to celebrate that this person has passed on to heaven, you know, is free from the trouble and toil and pain of mortal life." And so it's very, very celebratory too. I've showed some photos of Henry Nelson's funeral homegoing. They had his steel guitar up in front of his casket. And then also at the viewing the night before the wake, they had his finger picks on his hand, you know, to denote how important it was that he was a musician in the church. And he played in church for about 40 years. I think he was really a top musician and very, very influential to this day, even though he's deceased several years ago. The tributes are anniversaries, they're usually called, and it can be for a musician or a senior minister, or even a birthday celebration. I documented Ted Beard's 70th birthday celebration. They invited me up to Michigan for that, and documented tributes. And a tribute will include things like, of course, people will come to the podium and make remarks about the person that's who's being given the tribute, but they'll also make donations of cash or check donations to the which the MC handles. And of course, the way it works is that you're expected to reciprocate. You know, if you're being held in tribute, then next year you'll go to somebody else's tribute ceremony or anniversary and participate and donate and so forth. It's a long tradition in lots of African-American churches, not just these two.
Yeah, I'll say that the shot I really love the most, the photograph, is your tight shot of Henry Nelson's hands with his finger picks on it at the
waist. I'm so glad to hear that. You know, I was very careful. I cleared that with his surviving family members to make sure that they were okay, not so much with that shot, but the one where you can see his whole body. But, you know, I thought that was important to show those finger picks. Lorenzo Harrison, who was the second in command and the top musician who reigned supreme for decades in the Jewel Dominion, he was buried with a steel guitar. Henry was not buried with his, but Lorenzo Harrison was.
So you move from sort of these wakes and funerals into and gatherings to looking at style and adornment, the celebrating God's glory through style and adornment. So can you talk a little bit about what you're doing in this section and what you're sort of trying to show and portray?
Well, I dare say that most people are aware of, you know, gospel hats, women's hats, and certainly they're absolutely wonderful and fascinating, creative, you know, and they range from creations that were made by sort of cottage industry all the way to fancy professional designs. I've talked to women from South Florida who would fly to New York City to buy hats. I've talked to women that have 250 hats. Now, what's interesting is that it's you know, the scriptural basis of this is for covering your head. But then it got to be elaborate. It took off. There's also a scripture that says if you have long hair, if you have considerable hair, that can be considered a covering for your head. So there are some women who choose not to wear hats. Men, of course, don't wear hats in church, but hats are, they come and go in popularity. Right now, according to some people, they're seeing a renaissance in popularity. Men wear them to church, but not inside church. And of course, then there's the just the clothing and other accoutrements. What's interesting is that it's not monolithic. I'd say, especially among the men, there are men who wear who look like, you know, businessmen wearing a navy blue suits and conservative ties, and there are others who might wear red suits or not even a suit. But there's one fellow I photographed. It's too bad it's not in color, but he was wearing a neon green, you know, iridescent outfit. And there's some you know, differences of opinion among, especially among the men, you know, that's too much. You know, you shouldn't wear that to church. Or, you know, so some of the more conservative types must say, but they all view it as a way of expressing their God's glory and grace. And as one musician told me, and I've known him for years and seen him in many settings, both in church and casual clothes. He always looks really sharp. And he says, well, we're ambassadors for Christ. So when I'm out of my house, I always want to look my best, whether it's I'm in shorts and sneakers or going to church. I'm an ambassador for Christ, and I want to present myself that way and give glory to God.
Yes, I appreciated it in this section most of the photographs are of women and women in their hats, but that you do have a few photographs of men. So we sort of see that it isn't just about the women and the hats and that we sort of think about, but it is the whole community really thinking about how they are presenting themselves.
Yes, and of course, as you might imagine, and as you, I'm sure you observed, many photographs, you know, could be in one section or the other, you know. So, you know, you might have for instance, some of the portraits, the musicians are dressed up, and so they could go in the section about style and adornment. But of course, I had to. I had to balance this book, and one thing I was very aware of, and I had a friend who's also a visual artist who worked with me on, you know, when you open the book to a two-page spread, you don't want photos that conflict or compete with one another or just don't work together. And of course, if you move one to another section, you have to fill its place. And something I put quite a bit of work into. But yes, you and I think what's nice is if you read the little essay about style and adornment, then as you look at the other photos, you would be naturally aware that what's going on in terms of, you know, like the portrait of Aubrey Jen and his wife, what they're wearing, yeah, so forth.
Yeah, and yes, so that next section is the portrait. So could you share a little bit about, you know, sort of who you chose, sort of why, you know, a little bit about what you were trying to get at and do in that?
Well, the focus is primarily on the musicians. There's also some vocalists, singers, and I'm trying to think. Dorothy Ann Jacobs was a person who helped me a lot, just in various ways along my journey in documenting this, and we still keep in touch. And she had a very nice hairstyle, just had been done. So I wanted that. And just something where you can contemplate the individual a little more, you know, close up. And hopefully some of their personality comes through. That's the challenge. But I wanted to show that show that I have Lisa Lang in here, who's known as Lady of Steel. You know, she's in casual dress and just show the range of ages and personalities and hopefully bring some of that personality to the page.
Yes, I'm glad you brought up Lisa Lang because I was going to bring her up if you did it. To have a female. I really love what you captured with the Henry Nelson and Willie Easton photograph with them together. And I also really love the one on the Elder yes. Acorn Coffee with the guitar and with the, you know, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord and really and also coffee.
Yes, he was quite a guy and an important historical figure. So I was so glad I got that. It wasn't too many years later that he passed. And it was my good luck that he spent his whole life in Philadelphia. I'm not real sure when he was born. I haven't been able to determine that post-interview. He lived almost his whole life in Philadelphia. And then when he retired, they moved back to his home, his wife's home state of South Carolina, you know, kind of got away from the city. As you may know, interestingly enough, a lot of Black people whose families moved to the North during the Great Migration wind up retiring in the South. interesting.
So then you have a section on the Sacred Steel Conventions. So can you talk a little bit about those conventions? Because it seems like sometimes, because, well, the conventions and then you, the festivals and conferences, right? There's a little bit of controversy, I don't know if controversy is the right word, about sort of participating outside of the church, as you said before. So what have you got going on in that?
The Sacred Steel Conventions were special. The first one was held in 2000. They were not church events. They were events put on independent of the church by the musicians, of course, with the assistance of others, and to showcase their musical traditions. And the first one was at Rollins College in the Tony community town of Winter Park, Florida, the suburb of Orlando. And so it was a beautiful venue and had a great turnout, and people have come from Europe for these things. And so the first one was really special. One thing about it is that, you know, there's a hierarchy among the musicians. Like in this period I documented, there are only four musicians who played regularly at the big General Assembly in Nashville in the House of God. So this gave an opportunity for younger musicians and musicians who were not recognized at the top to play before the public on pretty much an equal footing. Naturally, the veterans and the big names like the Campbell Brothers, they got the prime spots, you know, on Saturday night. But still, the other musicians got to play on the same stage and were treated with great respect. So, and it continued to be a great venue, a format for presenting the young musicians. And because the MCs would be ministers, you know, the energy was at times got pretty close to what there would be in the praise music section of a worship service. So it really gave the public, you know, the outside public, an opportunity to witness this music in something very similar to a church setting in many ways, not entirely, of course. So they were quite popular. And then there was one event that I have in the same section that was called the Music Fest that I documented. And that was down in at the church in Pompano Beach. And that was, in fact, a church-sponsored event. And Dorothy Ann Jacobs was, I think, the head person that organized that. And her cousin is Daryl Blue, who's the resident steel guitarist at that church. It's a big church in an area with a dense population. So that was very similar, although there was it was actually in a church, and it was mostly a church crowd. There was, I don't think there was really any public there, except for me. They invited me down to document it. So that was an honor. And then we had one Sacred Steel Convention was held in conjunction at the Florida Folk Festival. It was across the street from the festival grounds in a community center. So again, we had all the festival goers, some of whom were aware of the Sacred Steel music and some who weren't and were exposed to it for the first time. And you know, the Florida Folk Festival is largely acoustic music. So, and the Sacred Steel players are characteristically quite loud. So we were in this venue across the street that was, you know, closed doors and air conditioned so they could cut loose. And it was a ball. It was great. And again, a lot of younger players got to showcase, and they came from, you know, they came from Detroit, and as far as that nobody was getting paid. They just came to be part of this whole community and show their stuff and enjoy the camaraderie and the fellowship.
Right, and you have that, you know, sort of blends in. You sort of mentioned the festivals and the concerts, and some photographs, a couple here even, yes, from Italy, right, where the tourings. Do you want? Is there anything you want to talk about with those, like, festivals and getting out?
Oh, absolutely. Let me say that of course, I would never try to coerce any folk artist, whether it's from this tradition or whatever, to do a public presentation. I would present the opportunity, and if they wanted to do it good, I'd do everything I could to facilitate them, both when I was working for the Florida Folk Life Program and then after. But there has always, since day one, I know at least it goes back to the Willie Eason in the late 1930s. The musicians are a draw, even for churches and gospel concerts. And so the musicians typically don't get paid much in church. They're a draw. They have the ability to make money. And so they want to play, and they like being heard and appreciated. And even though they're playing their same music at, you know, the National Folk Festival or whatever, they feel like they're really treated like royalty and recognized, and they're paid, well paid, and they like that. Some people in the church don't like that. So there's, you know, I ran into a folklorist a couple of times who was working on her PhD. She may not have been a folklorist. It was at SEM, Society for Ethnomusicology conferences. She was from Los Angeles, I think, and she was doing her doctorate on mega churches. And they have the same problem, only bigger, because you know, mega churches where they get congregations of 20,000 people, they have major gospel stars that play. And of course, they want to be paid, they want to be respected, but the clergy wants to be in control. So there's that consideration. And but getting to the photos, you know, there's one of the Calvin Cook playing at the National Folk Festival in East Lansing, Michigan. And then there's these two photos of the Campbell brothers. I went with them on one of their first, I don't think it was the first, maybe their second foray into Europe, but we were gone for a week out in Italy, based in Turin, and then went all the way up to the Aosta Valley. But they played in both large concert halls as well as historic churches. Excuse me, my book was falling. I had to catch it. They played in historic churches. And again, what I've tried to present in my book is images and content that's not available otherwhere. You can get on YouTube and you could watch Sacred Steel videos for the rest of your life. and especially, there's a lot of concert shots of the Campbell brothers and others who have been on tour and toured up until COVID stop things, but I've tried to present some of the earlier ones, and haven't, as you noticed, that's one of the smaller sections is the concerts and festivals, public performances.
And the sort of the last two sections move us. Well, the penultimate is on the centennial that took place in Nashville, Tennessee. So can you talk a little bit about that and why it was important to sort of focus or highlight the centennial as one of these sections in here and what you were trying
to do? As I mentioned early on, they claim the House of God, Keith Dominion, the Jewel Dominion, Church of the Living God, Jewel Dominion, they came from the same church. It was founded in 1903 by a woman, and they claim that that's the first Pentecostal church organization founded by a woman. And as far as I know, that's true. So they're very, very proud of that. And women still play a leadership role. In fact, the chief overseer, which is the leader, the national leader in both organizations today, is a woman. So they're very proud of that aspect. And, you know, the Keith Dominion, House of God Keith Dominion headquarters church is in Nashville. So they had a huge centennial event. I think it was almost a week long. It seems I went up there, it was at least 3 or 4 days. They had a parade with floats with musicians on many of the floats. They had a reenactor that looked like Mother dressed up in period costume, pulled by a horse-drawn, in a horse-drawn carriage, you know, to look like Mother Tate from 1903. There was, you know, they have a few churches in the British West Indies. They had a float from Jamaica. They had, of course, lots of lots of music and worship service. They had a visit to Mother Tate's gravesite. So it was, you know, it was definitely something I wanted to document, and I'm so glad I did. It was really special. And of course, it was, by that time, things were very, very comfortable for me because I had already been doing this for, 12 years. So pretty much everybody knew me. And what's more, they did their own audio and video recordings of all this. And the Campbell brothers, the Campbell family led that. And they actually hired me to write liner notes for their CD album that they produced. So it was a great time.
Yes, I was going to say, I really love the photograph of the Mary Tate portrayal with, I can't tell if it's a veil or like if she's just holding a,
yeah,
what she's holding. I think she's holding it, but I love that.
Oh, globe. Thank you. Yeah. It's just a scarf for a white, some sort of white fabric. Yes. Yeah. It was great. You know, great time. And, you know, people, the street they had it on is you know, there was a lot of people there not from the church, you know, so the public really enjoyed it. It was just wonderful. You know, a lot of pride there, and rightfully so.
And you end with a section called Generations, where you sort of photograph a lot of this is the more seasoned musicians, right? The more well-established musicians throughout the book, because they are the ones that are playing in the church and at the front of the church. But you have this final section where it's not only the church elders, but we have some younger members who are coming into this space. So can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to make sure to sort of get these young people and also sort of capture these young people in the book?
Well, the young people are very important, and this is a classic, this whole community is a classic example of how all the culture, not just the music, but I'd say especially the music, is transmitted informally from one generation to another. You know, it's not like any of this music is written down. Nowadays, you know, the younger musicians have the advantage of video. You could just use a cell phone to get a video of somebody playing. But, you know, in the old days, the musicians would go to the General Assembly once a year is a big thing. And musician, you know, aspiring young musicians, say from Florida, might go up there to Nashville, and they'd hear something new. You know, the steel guitarists that were playing always tried to come up with something a little bit new, and the musicians would hear that, and they'd have to, you know, whistle it or hum it to themselves all the way back home, you know, as they drove home. And to learn those new licks or those new phrases. Nowadays, there are some who have given workshops and lessons. And again, as I said, there's all a video on YouTube they can watch. So I'd say, without a doubt, the young people are learning much more quickly than they did in the old days. But still, the passing down from one generation to another, and especially, you know, to play the instrument is one thing, but to be a good church musician is yet another. I mean, the musician in the church is not there to show off their musical prowess. They're there to serve in the service and to enhance the service and to help the minister get the congregation to the level that they're trying to get, to fill the congregation with the Spirit. So it's definitely something that's passed from one generation to the next. And one example that I give is Willie Eason learned some things from his older brother, Troman, who was about 15 years older than him. There was 15 kids in the family or something. And that was back in the 1930s. And then when he was on the road as an itinerant musician, I came down to Ocala, Florida in the wintertime, and Henry Nelson, who was 10 years younger than Willie. So Henry was about 10 years old when he heard Willie. And he said, I wanted to do everything I saw. And then Henry's son, Aubrey Gent, is a very highly skilled musician on the lap steel, and who rose to prominence. And then his son, A.J. Gent, is playing both gospel and secular R&B. And he's not only a great steel player, but he's a singer, too. So that's essentially four generations, or depending how you look at it, three and a half or four generations. And that's just not, that's not untypical. That's what's going on. So it's very much a generational thing. And I wanted to bring that out. It's very important.
And one thing I wanted to ask about this section is that some of these photographs are 20 years old, right? The young people that you photographed are all adults now. So I'm wondering if any of them that you know of are now like playing in the church, and you might not, but if you do know sort of any of the projectors.
Yeah, I talked about Aubrey Gent's son, who's back. He's back in the conventions. Yes. I know Jason Haygood is playing. Elton Noble's son, Theon, plays guitar, fretted guitar, more than he does steel. But he's very much, he's an accomplished musician. Glenn Lee's, Alvin Lee's kids are still pretty young, but I would bet they're playing. In that one shot of Jamad Batts, the young fella in the striped sport coat.
Yes, I love that.
The little kid there who's sitting at the drums over to the right is Derek Lee Jr., one of the son of one of the Lee boys. And he's sometimes a substitute drummer for the Lee boys if their regular drummer can't make it, if they have a gig anywhere in the country, he plays. In fact, I had a little exhibit in Carrboro, North Carolina, and he saw that photo and he said, that's me. He says, you were there. And I said, I was there. I took the photo. And Jamad Batts, the young fellow at the steel, as far as I know, he's still playing. So yes, they continue. Absolutely. I can't speak for every one of them, but, as far as I know, they're all playing.
Yeah, it's always fun to sort of see them and then wonder. Because I was like, oh, they're all in their 20s.
Oh, yeah, they're married and have three kids. They're 20 to 30. It's pretty incredible. You know, I especially now that the book is out and I'm trying to make sure everyone's aware of the book. I visit a lot of people on Facebook, and I see this guy's 35 years old now, and has three kids. It's pretty striking. And I remember, Carlton Campbell, who's the drummer on that shot in Italy, that was a few years later, but when they first made their first recording here in Gainesville, I think he was 13 years old when he played drums on that CD. And now he's 35 years old, has three kids, and he's a professor at the college. He teaches audio recording engineering. In fact, they've done some virtual, some video presentations, they did one recently for the NCTA, National Council for Traditional Arts. And Carlton does all the engineering. He teaches it. So it's pretty incredible. Yes. It's been fun for me. And I do see some of these former youngsters every now and then. It's really great. Can't get over it.
So we've been talking for a while. And so my final question is usually if there's anything you're working on now, like if there's anything else you're working on or anything you're working on with this, that, you know, a final plug, if there's a final plug you have for anything that you're doing or working on.
Something different?
It doesn't have to be.
Well, this is my latest thing. I mean, this book was just published in December, so I'm working. And, you know, with the whole COVID thing, it's promoting the book. It's like I can't go out and do readings or you know, book events. I can do things virtually like this. But I'm trying to figure out how to do that. Well, you know, I'm 76, so I'm trying to be retired. But of course, this is all a labor of love. There's a local African American family. I live in Gainesville, Florida, and there's a family out towards Williston, about 15 miles from here, that has a roping rodeo they've been doing for about 25 years. And the name of their place is the Little Pigfoot Farm, which is a snappy name. They were three generations of butchers, and they used to mostly butcher hogs, so that's how they got the name. But what's really neat about it, it's this wonderful community event. Just because of the sheer demographics, there's more white people there than African-Americans. But African-Americans come from as far as Alabama and Georgia and maybe even farther for this annual event. So I've probably been there. It's annual, and I've been there 8 or 10 times. So I'm producing a book just for them to give to the brothers, the Wallace brothers. But it'll be for sale probably through Blurb, you know, just as a self-published print on demand, but it'll be available too. But that's a fun project. I have a lot of images, and I'm sorting through them. The other thing I'm working on every day almost is, they're keeping me pretty busy, is I donated my Sacred Steel photo archives and my interviews to the Arhuli Foundation. That's the nonprofit arm of Arhuli Records. And so I'm writing, they're posting some of the interviews right now. So I furnish a photo for each interview and then write a introductory paragraph about the interviewee. And they're keeping me pretty busy. They have contractors that are transcribing the interviews. And every time I turn around, they need 3 or 4 more photos. And they would ask me to proof the interview. And of course, I'm glad to do it. It's a lot of fun. And again, I've put information about those. I put updates on my Facebook page. And the community really, I'm so glad, they really love it. They can't, you know, they love that they're, you know, like Willie Easton's children and grandchildren, they can go hear Willie Easton. And when the photos are all digitized and up, they'll be able to look at them and, you know, make whatever arrangements are Hooli's going to have so they can get prints if they need to or whatever. So it's, that's really very nice. And of course, you know, I've had such a great working relationship with Arhuli and Chris Strachwitz, who's now retired. He's almost 90 years old. And as some people may know, the Arhuli record label has been bought by Smithsonian Folkways. So that's a great place for it to be. And so everything's, the future is good, and the foundation is active and growing, and I'm just proud to be part of it. And I think it's a wonderful place to have my archival goodies placed, my documentation placed.
Well, Bob, it's been really great talking to you. Again, this is Bob Stone, who is the author and photographer of Can't Nobody Do Me Like Jesus, Photographs from the Sacred Steel Community. Bob, thanks for being here with me on New Books Network, New Books and Popular
Culture. Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and hope to meet you in person someday. I've actually had, I just this Tuesday had my second vaccine shot, so hopefully we'll have a new life, maybe beginning in the second half of this year.
Yeah, yes, okay. Let's hope.